Each morning, when you work out your schedule for the day, quickly jot down in the notebook the date and the most important tasks that you are scheduled to get done. At the end of the day, if you've completed all of these tasks, simply jot down, all completed. If you fail to complete some tasks, record this along with a quick explanation. The system adds only an extra minute to your morning routine and requires only an extra minute each night before you go to sleep. It's simple enough to turn into a habit. What's amazing, however, is the journal's immediate effect. Having to record in ink on paper that you procrastinated over a task for no good reason is a powerful blow to your ego. It might be easy to tell yourself a few weak excuses for putting off a tedious assignment, but when you have to record these same excuses on paper, their foolishness is exposed. You can no longer get away with lame rationalizations. This is especially true if you continue to delay the same task day after day. After seeing all of those excuses pile up in your journal, there will be no escape from reality. You are being lazy. Your ego won't like this truth, so it will kickstart your motivation in an effort to avoid it. The journal, in this way, acts like a personal drill sergeant, sitting on your shoulder and yelling into your ear, "Soldier, I want you to get me a pillow, because I know I must be dreaming. I thought I just saw you consider not starting your paper this afternoon, and I know you wouldn't try to pull that crap with me standing right next to you. Now go grab your notes and get working before I make you record your laziness in ink where everyone can see it." Many students, myself included, don't keep a journal all the time, but use it to help them get through unusually busy periods. For example, my work progress journal was a key force in getting me through my senior fall semester, which involved classes, grad school applications, and the writing of my first book. Others have had great success with the journal to keep focused on their LSAT preparation while juggling the demands of regular classwork. Some students go so far as to use the system with a friend, agreeing to review each other's journal once a week. As Christine from Harvard suggests, if you have a friend in the same class, check up on each other's progress. And even if you can't find a willing journal partner, there are other ways to use friends to jumpstart your drive. It helps to simply tell your roommates of your goals and have them guilt trip you into working. Procrastination battle plan number 2. Feed the machine. Low energy breeds procrastination. Most students know the feeling. Your mind starts to feel sluggish. You begin to read whole pages of text without remembering a single word, and writing coherent notes becomes a Herculean task. It's almost impossible to motivate yourself to stick to a schedule under these mental conditions. Accordingly, during long work periods, you need to feed your body the fuel it needs to perform at its peak. Think of your brain like a machine. If you want to defeat procrastination, you need to provide it with the energy necessary to concentrate and win the fight. Without proper care, it will turn against you. The nutritional rules for maximizing your mental energy while studying are simple. 1. Drink water constantly. Have a water bottle with you or make frequent trips to the water fountain. One of my favorite study spots had a dispenser of mini paper cups next to the fountain. My habit was to drink 5 mini cups of water every 45 minutes. It worked wonders toward keeping my mind humming and my energy high. Your body needs water to function. Hydration increases your energy, masks boredom-induced food cravings, and staves off sleepiness. And don't worry about the inevitable side effect of so much drinking. As Greta, a straight-A Dartmouth student, exults, "Frequent bathroom trips keep me awake." 2. Monitor your caffeine intake carefully. Don't drink more than one large caffeinated beverage in any one-hour period. While a Coke or a cup of coffee can heighten your concentration, too much caffeine in a short period will make you jumpy and unfocused. If you're a coffee drinker, start off with a strong brew to jumpstart your mind, but switch to decaf, tea, or just water for the next hour or two before returning to another strong drink. 3. Treat food as a source of energy, not satisfaction. When studying, carefully choose snacks that promise a long-term energy boost. Try vegetables, fruit, anything whole grain, lean proteins, peanuts, or natural granola bars. Refined carbohydrates, such as sugar and white flour, will provide only a quick energy rush followed immediately by a damaging energy drain and increased appetite. Avoid these unhealthy snacks at all costs while working. If you follow Rule 1, your frequent water consumption will dull the cravings for specific foods, making it much easier to stick with healthier fare. 4. Don't skip meals. Snacks alone are not enough to fuel your mind for long periods. Even on the busiest of days, eat regular meals. If you skip breakfast to get a jump start on studying or put off lunch until the late afternoon so you can finish your reading, you will experience more hunger than your snacks can effectively satisfy. Hunger and the corresponding low blood sugar will rob you of your ability to concentrate and set you up to succumb to procrastination. So keep your meals regular. If you're pressed for time, eat fast. Grab a sandwich from a less populated dining hall and sit alone. Or bring part of the meal back to your study location, but never miss meals altogether. Procrastination battle plan number 3. Make an event out of the worst tasks. Some tasks are so horrible that even just the thought of beginning them can send chills down your spine. For me, these included writing personal statements for graduate school applications. Other students cringe at having to type the first few paragraphs of a long paper, composing cover letters for job applications, or beginning the slog through a hopelessly large reading assignment on a hopelessly boring topic. I can't help but remember one particularly descriptive article I had to read about the various clays used in ancient Cypriot vase making. It seems to take an extraordinary effort to start these projects before the last possible minute, but it doesn't have to be this difficult. As Laura, a straight-A Dartmouth student, explains, when studying for something I don't especially enjoy, I try to make an event out of it. Find an out-of-the-way restaurant, coffee shop, or bookstore cafe. It helps if your location is farther than walking distance from campus. Set a time to bring your work there, and if you don't have a car, arrange to be dropped off and picked up later, or choose a location that takes a while to reach by foot so you won't be tempted to leave right away. Tell everyone you know that you will be gone during this time, and talk up how horrible the work is that you have to complete. The more people who know about your quest, the harder it will be for you to cancel it. The novelty of the location, plus its distance from campus, will help jumpstart your motivation to tackle your horrible task once there. I find the change of scenery puts your body in work mode, just as going to the office is supposed to, explains Sean, a straight-A student from Yale. You went through a lot of effort to get to your unusual study nook, and there is no easy way to be distracted. Campus is far away, and therefore so are your friends, your TV, the student center, and your internet connection. You are sitting alone at a table in a public place, surrounded by strangers, and if you don't start doing something soon, people will begin to wonder, who is that odd student sitting alone and staring into space? Is she a drifter? Is she going to snap and kill us all? What's her deal? It's just too awkward to sit there while staring at other people, says Laura. So inevitably, I will end up reading whatever material I've brought with me. As always, the hardest part is beginning. But once you start slogging through your assignment, the pain will slip away, you will hit your stride, and before you know it, your ride will have arrived and that once terrifying task will be safely completed. Procrastination battle plan number 4. Build a routine. Your schedule varies each day, but you should be able to identify at least 1 hour on each weekday that is consistently free. If you have an early class, make this the hour right after it lets out. If you have a late morning class, make this the hour right before it starts. In general, the morning and early afternoon are the best times to find these consistently free hours. Time in the late afternoon and evening is much more susceptible to being hijacked by unexpected events as your friends finish up their classes and start knocking on your door. Once you've identified these protected hours, use them to do the same work each week. For example, maybe Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays are for chipping away at your history reading assignments, and Tuesdays and Thursdays are for making progress on your weekly statistics problem set. The idea is to build a routine in which you use the same reserved time slot each week to do the same thing, with the goal of transforming these slices of work into a habit, something you no longer have to convince yourself to do. I figured out pretty early on, the most annoying thing about bad habits, namely their tenacity, could be very useful if it was applied to other things, explains Simon, a straight-A student from Brown. I found that good habits, like making sure I do certain work at the same time each week, are really hard to get rid of. Unfortunately, these 5 hours a week are probably not enough to complete all of your work, if only that were true. But they do represent 5 hours of productivity that didn't exist before. And more important, the first work of the day breaks the seal on your motivation. Once you have accomplished one big task, it becomes much easier to tackle more. So, follow Simon's advice and let this simple good habit greatly reduce the effort required to launch a productive day. Procrastination battle plan number 5. Choose your hard days. Hard days are inescapable at college. Sometimes you simply have more work due than you can handle with a well-balanced schedule. In these cases, relaxation and socializing have to take a backseat to your study obligations, as Jeremy, a straight-A student from Dartmouth, admits, "Occasionally I end up setting aside one full day where I just lock myself in my room with some food and grind through it." You can't avoid these hard days, but you can control their impact. If you see a large number of deadlines looming just over the horizon, you can be sure that there will be some hard days in your near future. Here's the secret. Plan them in advance. Don't wait until the deadlines are so close that you have no choice but to buckle down. Instead, scout out 1 or 2 days to preemptively designate as hard. By choosing them ahead of time, you can space them out so that you never have 2 hard days in a row, and you won't be caught off guard by this sudden burst of intensity. Try to plan relaxing, non-academic activities immediately before and after these days. This will ease their impact, as Jeremy explains. If I work all day Saturday, I will let myself go out hard on Saturday night and take Sunday off. In addition, you should prepare yourself mentally. Tell friends which days are going to be hard. Warn them not to expect much communication from you, and ask for their encouragement. If all of your friends know that Tuesday is going to be a rough day for you, then you will be much more likely to keep busy and do the work. It would be embarrassing, after all, to talk up your upcoming hard day, garnering sympathy and support from friends, and then be discovered that afternoon still in your boxers experimenting with the use of your toes as an alternative to your missing remote control. By proactively scheduling hard days on a regular basis, you reduce their negative impact. When you are forced into an all-day work marathon against your wishes, you feel drained and abused. If that same day has been planned and hyped for the past week, you'll come away feeling invigorated by your accomplishment. You expected the challenge, prepared for the challenge, and survived it. This strategy is more psychological than time-saving, but the effect is powerful. Take ownership of your schedule, and you are more likely to respect it. Step 3. Choose when, where, and how long. The little things count. This is especially true when it comes to studying. Before we get caught up in the details of exactly how to review and synthesize material, there are some basic questions that we must address first. When during the day should you study? Where should you go to study? How long should you study before taking a break? The right answers to these questions will boost your productivity, allowing you to squeeze more work out of even less time. The wrong answers will slow you down and make this process more difficult than it needs to be. Straight-A students, I found out, devote a lot of thought to these questions. They recognize how these seemingly little details can make or break their study efforts and have experimented extensively to discover the most effective strategies. Step 3 will walk you through the results of these experiments and present tested approaches for each of these 3 crucial study skills. Question: when is the best time to study? Answer: early. I like doing work in one big chunk upon getting back from class or doing it in between classes depending on my schedule, says Simon from Brown. I try to never leave it until late at night. Simon's plan emphasizes an important reality about studying. You're most effective between when you wake up and when you eat dinner. You should accomplish as much work as possible during this time. This advice runs counter to most students' instincts. To many, the evening seems ideal for work. Why? Because the morning and afternoon are crowded. Classes, meals, meetings, and other activities take over these hours, leaving few continuous periods for really settling in and getting things done. Night, on the other hand, seems like one long, uninterrupted stretch of good work time, right? Wrong. First, nighttime is not as long as you think. By the time you finish dinner, gather your materials, and finally begin your work, you really have only a few hours left before it becomes too late and your desire to sleep hijacks your concentration. Second, nighttime is not as free as you think. It's prime time. Inevitably, some can't-miss TV show nags for your attention, or the loud music of a party down the hall beckons seductively. Night is when people most want to socialize. You see movies at night, you go to parties at night, shows, speakers, and other campus performances happen at night. People gather back at their dorm rooms to gossip and distract each other. Few among us have achieved the required level of nerddom necessary to resist such temptations, and we shouldn't have to. Finally, nighttime is when your body begins to wind down. After a long day of activity, it's ready to begin a slow descent into sleep. Even before it gets late, the energy available to your mind has already declined. By 7 or 8 p.m., your focus is weak at best. For these reasons, you must minimize the amount of work you do after dinner. At the same time, however, it's true that working during the day can also be complicated. As mentioned, there are few continuous stretches of free time in the morning and afternoon. Don't fear this fractured schedule. Bring your materials with you throughout the day and fill in any small patches of free time with productive work. As Wendy, a straight-A student from Amherst, explains, I try to take a book I need to read along with me all the time in case some free time pops up while I'm doing something else. Doris from Harvard has a similar philosophy, admitting that she sneaks in work between meetings or classes using small blocks of 30 or 45 minutes at a time. If you follow this approach, you'll be surprised at the amount of work you can squeeze into your hectic daytime schedule. The trick is to be efficient. If you have an hour in between classes, head straight from the first class to a library or similar study location near the second class. Mentally prepare yourself on the way over so that when you hit the study spot, you can become productive within seconds. Also, be sure to avoid your dorm room or other public places as much as possible during the day. You need to separate your work mindset from your relaxation mindset. By hanging around your room or the student center, you are much more likely to become distracted and let a potentially productive work period slip away at the expense of a mundane conversation. Become a ghost during the day. Like an academic ninja, slip from hidden study spot to hidden study spot, leaving only an eerie trail of completed work behind you. See the next question, where should you study, for more advice on choosing the right locations. The idea here is not to become antisocial. When you're done for the day, feel free to go have fun. Party like a demon. You aren't missing out on an important social event by avoiding some half-assed gossip between classes. The more meaningful experiences will happen later, at the frats or in your dorm room after everyone is done with classes for the day. Remember, work hard, play hard is always better than work kind of hard, play kind of hard. In addition to the extra energy and better focus that you gain by studying early, the spread-out nature of this schedule makes it less of a strain. Working for 45 minutes, running to class, working for an hour, going to another class, then working another 45 minutes before grabbing lunch is much less odious than sitting down and working for 2.5 hours straight. This approach also makes optimal use of your time. Most students simply waste these free chunks during the day. By taking advantage of daytime study pockets, you're freeing up valuable nighttime hours to go out and have the sort of fun that defines the college experience. Question: where should you study? Answer: in isolation. Identify a number of isolated study spots spread out across campus and rotate through these hidden locations when you study. Any place in your dorm or house is off limits, as are the big public study spaces in your main library. As Greta from Dartmouth explains, if you stay in your dorm, it seems like no one is studying, because they aren't. This atmosphere is not conducive to concentration. Look for less visited libraries away from the center of campus and search out carrels high up in the stacks or buried down in the basement. Always keep your eyes open for the next great hidden study spot. Small libraries in the buildings of student organizations, a hole-in-the-wall coffee shop, or the local public library are all potential concentration gold mines. You need multiple locations for two reasons. First, as you move through your day squeezing in study sessions between classes, it's nice to always know of a nearby study spot. Second, changing locations prevents you from burning out at any one place. This is the strategy followed by Doris from Harvard, who explains, "To keep my mind stimulated, I regularly rotate between different venues." The isolation of these spots is important for the obvious reason. It shields you from distraction. That little procrastination devil on your shoulder is an incredible salesman. If you give him even a glimpse of an alternative to your work, then he will close the deal. To neutralize this devil, isolate him. Don't let him see your couch, the cute girls tossing frisbees on the quad, or your friends chatting in your dorm room lounge. If you cut yourself off from the outside world during your work hours, then you have a much better chance of completing what needs to get done. And, as an added bonus, the resulting increase in concentration will help you get your work done faster. Many students will admit that there is something a bit dramatic about working in exaggerated isolation. It may sound corny, but quarantining yourself in a study bunker seems to increase the importance of the work you are about to tackle. You can almost imagine the voice of a grave military officer saying, "Son, we're all counting on you. Good luck," as you head off to your silent nook. This kind of gravitas is lacking when you flop down on your couch with a textbook propped up on your chest and your roommate in the chair next to you struggling to learn an obnoxious Dave Matthews song on his out-of-tune guitar. As Christine from Harvard states plainly, studying in bed has never worked. These mind games are not trite. Don't underestimate the importance of psychology in becoming an effective student. Almost every straight-A student interviewed for this book followed some variant of this isolation strategy. Some went so far as to wear earplugs or travel great distances from campus to eliminate any chance of distraction. They understood the mental edge their surroundings provided, and you should too. Question: how long should you study? Answer: no more than 1 hour at a time without a break. Your break needs to be only 5 to 10 minutes, but it's important that you take an intellectual breather during this period. This means you should find something you can concentrate on for just a few minutes, which has nothing to do with the work you were completing right before the break. Read a newspaper article or send a few emails. That should be enough. This disengagement helps refresh your mind and facilitates the process of finding new angles and insights when you begin your work again. Some students brought a novel or newspaper with them and then read a chapter or an article at every break. Others chose a project for the day, perhaps writing a long email to a friend they hadn't seen in ages or building a list of options for an upcoming vacation that they could work on bit by bit with each break they took. Even when you feel like you are on a roll, keep taking regular breaks. Over the long run, it will maximize your energy and retention of the material. As Laura from Dartmouth recounts, "I swear I get more done taking regular breaks than I would if I just worked straight through." Why does this timing work the best? I don't know exactly. Some cognitive science research concludes that about 50 minutes is the optimal learning period to maximize the material synthesized per time unit. For example, the website for the IPFW Center for Academic Support and Advancement states, "Studies suggest you should study in 40 or 50-minute increments for maximum retention. After approximately 40 minutes, take a short break, 5 minutes, and continue studying. Without a break, retention is about 30% after 2 hours. But we don't have to get bogged down with these scientific details. The main reason I advocate this timing is because almost every straight-A student interviewed for this book followed a similar plan. When asked how long they studied in a single sitting, all but a few of their answers fell somewhere between half an hour and an hour. "Not more than an hour," replied Chris. "1 hour, then I get up and do something else for a bit," replied Melanie. "About 40 minutes to an hour," replied Ryan. 1 hour on, 15 minutes off," replied Lydia. 1 to 1.5 hours, then I would always take a break," replied Lacey, and the list goes on. As response after response revealed a similar strategy. The point here should be clear. Through trial and error, dozens of high-performing students have individually stumbled across this same technique. Study for an hour, then take a break. So, you should trust it too. Part 1 Cheat Sheet. Step 1. Manage your time in 5 minutes a day. Jot down to-dos and deadlines on a list whenever they arise. Transfer these to-dos and deadlines to your calendar every morning. Plan your day each morning by labeling your to-dos with realistic time frames and moving what you don't have time for to different dates. Step 2. Declare war on procrastination. Keep a work progress journal and every day record what you wanted to accomplish and whether or not you succeeded. When working, eat healthy snacks to maximize your energy. Transform horrible tasks into a big event to help you gather the energy to start. Build work routines to make steady progress on your obligations without expending too much of your limited motivational resources. Choose your hard days in advance to minimize their impact. Step 3. Choose when, where, and how long. Try to fit as much work as possible into the morning and afternoon between classes and obligations. Study in isolated locations. Take a break every hour. Part 2. Quizzes and exams. Students who develop superior study skills can do more in less time. Riel, a straight-A college student. Here's a simple truth. Most college students are terrible at studying. It's not really their fault. When students arrive at college, they're on their own. No one ever takes them aside to teach them the right way to study, so most students just make it up as they go along. For example, when an exam date looms, the typical student pulls out his books and notes and then cloisters himself in his dorm study lounge or at the desk in his room. At this point, he begins reviewing almost at random, poring over as many notes and chapters as he can manage, with frequent breaks to converse with friends and check email until finally his will to continue completely flickers out. If he's particularly industrious, he might manage to pull an all-nighter. Otherwise, he'll probably call it quits by midnight. The next day, he takes the exam, bleary-eyed, completely unsure of what grade to expect. Occasionally, this approach earns him an A-, but for the most part, he remains wearily ensconced in the world of B's and the occasional C. There are two problems with this approach. First, there's the timing. In part one, I introduced the term pseudo-work to describe this unfortunate habit of studying in long, low-intensity, fatigue-saturated marathons of pain. To counter this behavior, we discussed some intelligent time management strategies to help you spread out your work into small, high-intensity bursts. The second problem with this approach is the technique. As shown in the previous scenario, the typical student studies by performing rote review, the reading and rereading of assignments and notes as many times as possible. The idea behind this strategy is that somehow, if the material crosses before your eyes enough times, the key ideas will stick around long enough to be later regurgitated during the exam. Here's the problem with rote review. It's a horrible way to study. First of all, it doesn't work. Even though you spend a lot of time, you don't end up actually learning the material well. Methodically trying to reread every source covered in class is an incredibly inefficient way to prepare. And because it's boring, your mind quickly fatigues, and once your mind shuts down, you can forget about synthesizing complicated arguments. To successfully learn even a modest amount of information using this technique requires an absurd number of hours. The second problem with rote review is that it's really painful. There is no way around it. Cramming is mind-numbing, especially when you have a hopelessly large amount of material to review. Here's the good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Not convinced? What follows are real quotes from some of the straight-A students interviewed for this book. I never do all-nighters. I have a great deal of free time. Balance is very important for me. I have tons of free time nearly every day. I worked hard at first, but by junior and senior year, I was having a blast. I spent relatively little time in college doing homework or reading. I get my work done quickly in the morning and then have plenty of time for uninterrupted playing. Many students find these claims to be hard to believe because they contradict a cherished piece of conventional wisdom. High-scoring students must be grinds. Where does this belief come from? For one thing, as Matthew, a straight-A student from Brown, explains, there are people who devote their lives to the grind, and these students tend to be very visible. They complain incessantly about the amount of work they have to do, constantly check in with their friends to compare study hours, and can be seen camped out in the library during most times of the day. If you encounter enough of these public grinds, it can begin to seem like they represent what is necessary to achieve academic success. However, there is another, more insidious reason why this belief persists. Most students incorrectly believe rote review is the only way to study. Think about this for a moment. If you assume that all studying is equal, then the conclusion that all straight-A students are grinds becomes unavoidable. We noted earlier that making high grades with rote review requires an absurd number of hours. Therefore, if rote review is the only way to study, then high-scoring students must be studying a lot more than the average student. This is why, before we continue, you must first understand and accept this crucial fact. There are many, many different ways to study, and rote review is not one of the better ones. Once you reject the idea that all studying is equal, and instead make the crucial connection that studying is like any other skill, and as with any skill, it can be done well or done poorly, then the premise of this book starts to make sense. Non-grind straight-A students are not unexplainable or incredible. They have simply mastered, either through aggressive trial and error or interactions with older straight-A students, study strategies that are far superior to rote review. Let me put it another way. If we make an analogy between college and professional basketball, then the rote reviewing students are all shooting the ball underhand granny style, while the non-grind straight-A students are those who figured out how to shoot a jump shot. It doesn't matter if the rote reviewers practice those granny shots twice as many hours as the straight-A students. When it's game time, the jump shooters are going to score a lot more points. Better technique trumps more effort. Part 2 will teach you, in essence, how to shoot an academic jump shot. It covers the nuts and bolts of smart exam preparation, the many small techniques refined by straight-A students over countless semesters that add up to a much better way to study. Forget everything you think you know about preparing for exams and approach the steps that follow with an open mind. Some of this advice will make immediate sense, some will seem obvious, and some will surprise you. But just remember that these tactics are not arbitrary. They are not based on one guy's experience, and they certainly are not abstract theories spouted by some self-proclaimed expert. Instead, they are the realistic strategies developed by real straight-A students to ace tests under the harsh demands of a college workload. If you combine these tested study skills with the time management techniques taught in Part 1, you will find yourself scoring higher, learning more, and studying less than you previously thought possible. Quizzes versus exams. In general, all of the advice described in Part 2 will work for both quizzes and exams, but in the case of quizzes, it's not always necessary to put in quite as much effort, though it certainly doesn't hurt. But first things first, let's get our definitions correct. Keep in mind that professors often use the terms quiz and exam interchangeably, so forget what they say and make your own determination about a given test. Here's a simple rule to follow. If the test is worth less than 15% of your final grade, it's a quiz. Otherwise, it's an exam. If the test is worth only 5% or less of your grade, designate this a tiny quiz. Don't spend too much time on tiny quizzes. Even if you fail one, it still probably won't change your final letter grade. And if you're attending classes and keeping up with your reading, you should be able to score above average with little to no preparation. For larger quizzes, you can more or less follow the advice in this section, but feel free to move more quickly through the review-focused steps, steps 3 and 4. If you don't master every last topic that might be covered on a quiz, that's okay. A missed question here or there won't make a big difference on your final grade. And if you treat every quiz like a midterm, you're going to overload your schedule. Quizzes are checkups, not comprehensive evaluations, so treat them as such. The only exception, of course, is if your grade is in danger. If you're in academic trouble, perhaps due to a poor performance on a previous exam or paper, then go all out in your review. If you apply the full force of the study strategies that follow, you will be guaranteed to knock any quiz out of the park. Step 1. Take smart notes. First things first. Always go to class. The importance of this rule cannot be overemphasized. It doesn't matter if your class meets at 6 a.m. at the top of the steepest hill on campus on Saturday mornings. Wake up, get dressed, and get to the lecture on time. As Lydia, a straight-A student from Dartmouth, explains, if you skip class, it'll take twice as long studying to make up for what you missed. This is why class attendance is so important. Not because learning is power, or it's what your parents would want you to do, but because it saves you time. If you attend class regularly, you will significantly cut down on the amount of studying required to score high grades. Don't make this negotiable. Even if you're tired, hungover, or extremely busy, find a way to make it there. Of course, just going to class isn't enough by itself. To reduce your study time, you have to also take good notes once you're there. Keep this in mind. Note-taking is an art form. Doing it well requires expert guidance, and fortunately, there is no better place to look for expert guidance than real straight-A students. Here are their proven note-taking strategies. Gather the right materials. When I was a freshman, less than half of my class brought a laptop to campus. The year I graduated, over 95% of incoming freshmen brought laptops. By the time you listen to this, laptops will more or less be the de facto standard for undergraduates across the country, and this is a great advancement for the cause of collegiate note-taking. Why? I think David, another Dartmouth student, put it best. Use your laptop. Seriously. You will be overwhelmed by the quality and legibility of your notes. It's really a no-brainer. Yes, it may seem somewhat geeky, but it's becoming increasingly common, and besides, the academic advantages far outweigh any minor social stigma. As mentioned by David, you type much faster than you write, so the laptop will allow you to record more points in more detail. This increased detail and readability will make it easier to study come test time, and that should be all you need to hear. If you don't have a laptop, then make sure you have one notebook for every class and a pen that you are comfortable with. Try to write clearly. You might even consider typing summaries of your notes at the end of each week. I sometimes followed this strategy in my pre-laptop days and found that it saved me significant study time in the long run. There is, however, one obvious exception to this laptop rule. For math, science, economics, and engineering courses that are heavy on numbers and equations, pencil and paper are acceptable. Some people are comfortable approximating complicated mathematical symbols on their laptop, while others are not. If you fall into the latter category, don't worry about using a notebook. For a technical course, the difference between the two mediums is less important. Finally, you should also have one folder for each class. Every piece of paper you receive during a lecture, outlines, assignment descriptions, reading excerpts, should be dated and put in this folder. The same goes for graded problem sets and papers. The folders will make it much easier to find materials when you need them later for review. A lot of experts recommend needlessly complicated additions to this basic material list. They talk of using multiple colored pens, special notebooks, and organized class binders equipped with portable three-hole punches. Real straight-A students ignore this nonsense. As Anna, a straight-A Dartmouth student, warns, a lot of students focus on making their notebooks look pretty and then forget about the content. Put your notes on your laptop and your loose papers in a folder, and you'll be fine. Take smart notes in non-technical courses. What's the big idea? A non-technical course refers to any course outside of math, science, economics, and engineering. We're talking about English, history, psychology, political science, anthropology, classics, education, basically anything that doesn't make frequent use of mathematical formulas. These courses are the domain of ridiculously long reading assignments and dignified professors lecturing from behind a podium. The key to doing well in these courses is straightforward. Identify the big ideas. That's what it all comes down to. Exams in non-technical courses focus entirely on big ideas. They require you to explain them, contrast them, and reevaluate them in the light of new evidence. If you are aware of and understand all of the big ideas presented in the course, these tasks are not so difficult, and strong grades will follow. As you would expect, lectures are a major source of these big ideas. Identifying them, however, is not a trivial task. Professors ramble, and they rarely start a class by clearly identifying the big ideas that will be explored. Instead, they tend to dive right in, leaving the poor student to separate on his own the interesting conclusions from the digressions. A whole lot of superfluous things are said in each class, explains Jeremy, a straight-A student from Dartmouth. You have to learn how to pick out which is which. This is hard, and as such, most students don't take very good notes in non-technical courses, which has major ramifications when it comes time to study. If your notes don't already clearly identify the big ideas, then you are going to be forced to try to figure them out from scratch while reviewing. Allow me to spoil this particular ending for you. Unless you set aside dozens of hours to prepare, you're not going to accomplish this task, and your grade on the exam becomes a crapshoot. If the exam happens to ask questions that deal with the random assortment of ideas that you do know, then you might do okay. But if it happens to ask questions that deal with many of the big ideas that you never learned, then you will do poorly. Obviously, you want to avoid this situation. The solution is to figure out how to take notes that clearly identify and explain all of the big ideas that are presented so that you can review them later without spending any extra time. Let's jump right into the details of how to accomplish this goal. Format your notes aggressively. When you first arrive at the classroom, date your notes and record the title of the day's lecture, if it's available. If you're using a laptop, create a separate notes directory for each class. Save your document in this folder with the date in the file name. This will make it easier to organize the material when you review. When it comes to formatting the text itself, the basic rule to follow is that anything that makes the information easier to read is fair game. You don't need a consistent scheme. Don't be afraid to use aggressive text formatting to help emphasize important points. On a computer, smart students often make use of bold fonts and lists to help organize their thoughts. When using a pen and paper, underlining, indentations, drawing boxes around ideas, and bullet points also help structure the information. If you're defining a word, make it bold. If you're writing down an exception to the last observation you recorded, start with, however. Christine, a straight-A Harvard student, suggests that you develop your own shorthand, ESP for especially, NA for North America, etc. Skip lines with wild abandon, use tabs freely, change the font size, write entire sentences in all caps, throw around asterisks like penny candy, have fun, and do whatever helps you visualize the important concepts. Your notes are for you and you alone, explains Lee, a straight-A Columbia student. They don't have to make sense to anyone else. Capture big ideas by using the question, evidence, conclusion structure. The central challenge to note-taking in non-technical courses is deciding what to write down. Some students attempt to record the lecture verbatim. Don't do this. The best advice I can give on note-taking, explains Doris, a straight-A student from Harvard, is not to try to write down everything the professor says because that is both impossible and counterproductive. Put simply, you can't write that fast, and you will end up expending too much energy capturing exact words as opposed to identifying big ideas. Instead, remember the following structure. Question, evidence, conclusion. Most big ideas in non-technical courses are presented in this structure. Why? Professional academics think in terms of questions. This is how they see the world. To them, in order to find big ideas, you must first find questions and then follow a path of evidence to a corresponding conclusion. Accordingly, this is also how professors lecture. They offer up questions and then walk you through various pieces of evidence en route to an interesting conclusion. You should take advantage of this reality by recording all your notes in a question, evidence, conclusion format. The basics of this approach are simple. All of the information you write down during class should be associated with a well-labeled question. Each question should be paired with a well-labeled conclusion. When you're done, your notes for a given lecture should consist only of a bunch of question-conclusion pairs, each separated by points of evidence that support why the conclusion is a reasonable answer to the question. In other words, your goal is to fit all the facts and observations spewed out during class into this nice, simple structure. Keep in mind that professors don't always state the question. Often they jump right into the evidence and leave it to you to deduce the question being discussed. Don't be afraid to jot down question and then leave the rest of the line blank as you begin recording evidence. Once you figure out what the professor's talking about, you can go back and fill in this blank. The same holds true for conclusions. Professors will sometimes hint at a conclusion, but not come right out and present a neat endpoint for the current discussion. In this case, it will be up to you to synthesize the question, evidence, and professor's hints into a conclusion of your own. This is the important part. When you formulate a conclusion, you are cementing a big idea. If you can't finalize a conclusion before the professor moves on to the next question, simply jot down conclusion and plan to come back later during a lull in the lecture or immediately following class to fill in the blank. Something to remember. Conclusions are rarely simple. Professors often offer conclusions that only summarize the complexity of the issue. Consider, for example, the following question from a literature class. Who was the greatest novelist of the 20th century? A simple conclusion might be Hemingway. And the evidence in this case might be several points highlighting the influence and originality of Hemingway's work. On the other hand, it's much more likely that a college professor would offer up a more complicated conclusion to this question, perhaps something like, different generations answered this question differently, depending on the prevailing social issues of their time. In this case, the evidence could be excerpts from scholars of various periods talking about their favorite novelists, as well as some observations concerning the differing social climates during each of these eras. The more classes you take, the better you will become at summarizing a complicated conclusion. In the beginning, don't be afraid to ask questions to help figure out if your conclusions are correct or not. If you're shy, go up to the professor after class or become a regular during his office hours. Professors love this kind of student interaction. Use it to help polish your conclusion sleuthing skills. Another important tip, take full advantage of lulls in the lecture. As hinted before, some professors shoot out information so fast that there doesn't seem to be enough time to jot down every question or think about every conclusion. Sometimes it takes all of your energy just to keep up with the evidence. In this case, wait for slow spots. When the professor wanders off on a personal anecdote, or a student interrupts with an inane question, use this time to hurriedly go back and clean up what you have been throwing down. Record conclusions, clarify questions, and add illustrative formatting to pieces of evidence. If you're not rushed, spend 5 minutes after class to polish your notes before packing up. As Doris from Harvard explains, it's important to read over your notes right after class to absorb them and make corrections and additions. Otherwise, you'll be susceptible to entirely forgetting what was covered that day. These little moments and adjustments will make a big difference when it comes time to review. Finally, remember that the number of questions presented in a discussion can vary significantly depending on the class. One professor may spend an entire lecture exploring a single question, whereas another may move through a dozen small questions in the space of an hour. Often a professor will introduce a major question for the whole lecture and then spend the time exploring smaller questions that help build toward an overarching conclusion. Again, the more classes you take, the more intuitive these structures will become. If you pay attention to the contours of a professor's lecture, explains Matthew from Brown, you can determine what he feels is important. Listen for pauses, which usually follow key points, and remember that personal anecdotes are often spun during less important parts of the class. In general, there is no right or wrong way to break up a particular lecture into question-conclusion pairs, so just find a structure that more or less works. Feel free to mess around with your notes as you go along. Add or remove questions on the fly. If certain evidence doesn't seem to fit with any particular question, no matter how hard you try, that's okay. Just label it as such. Professors have been known to wander. By simply attempting to associate all information with questions and conclusions, you are already a large step ahead of most students when it comes to understanding and internalizing the big ideas. A brief example. Here is an excerpt from a real college lecture on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. It's followed by an example of how a straight-A student might take notes on this discussion. Keep in mind that the student here would have probably first recorded the evidence bullet points on the fly and then gone back later to fill in the question and conclusion once he had a better idea of where the professor was heading. Also note that the evidence features a lot of aggressive formatting. It's split up into lists, with words often bolded and capitalized to emphasize their importance. There is no consistent scheme being applied here. The formatting is just what might come naturally to the student during the heat of the moment to help him understand and underscore the concepts being presented. Lecture excerpt. The focus of today's lecture is what is called the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. The idea that the Roman Empire fell to the savage barbarian hordes has been a popular one ever since the 18th century. Edward Gibbon's book by that title pointed to two causes, in his mind, of Rome's decline and fall: Christians and barbarians. Sometimes he even confused the two. Gibbon argued that Christianity attracted the least intellectual and most superstitious elements in the empire, and that, not surprisingly, did the triumph of Christianity in the empire coincide with the downfall of Rome. Christians, according to Gibbon, undermined, with their ideas of forgiveness and mercy, the severe patriotic virtues of the Romans that had enabled them to resist heroically the barbarian invasions. Rostov Steff and Toynbee had a similar argument, but instead of blaming the Christians, they looked for social and political causes. Both argued that sometime in the 3rd century, the Roman ruling elite lost its political and intellectual nerve and allowed lesser elements to take over who were much less capable of holding the empire together under the onslaught of barbarians. All of these historians, however, looked at the history of Rome in the years 250 to 500 from a point of view that geographically was very narrow. These historians lived, after all, in a world where the center of European civilization was no longer the Mediterranean Sea, but northwestern Europe. They focused, then, on what France and Britain looked like in the 6th century AD and assumed that northwest Europe was the natural heir to classical antiquity. In fact, Only in the Latin West was there anything like a decline and fall, and even there the collapse was administrative. It was not an immediate or huge catastrophe, but a gradual ebb of Roman influence over those areas that had begun in the 3rd century. Excerpts drawn from The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, copyright 2000 by Philip Gavitt, Professor of History, St. Louis University, St. Louis, Missouri. Notes on excerpt. Question. Was there really a big fall of the Roman Empire? Roman Empire having a catastrophic decline and fall at the hands of savage barbarians, popular idea since 18th century. Edward Gibbon wrote book blaming fall on Christians and barbarians. Christian beliefs replaced heroic virtues, weakened military, let barbarians take over. Rostov Steff and Toynbee wrote books with similar arguments, except not Christians' fault, but social and political problems that led to weak empire. However, these views are geographically narrow. Authors lived in Europe, so they focused on Europe, only place where it looked like empire had a big fall. Loss of power in Mediterranean region, not nearly so pronounced. No real big decline and fall there. Conclusion, the idea of a catastrophic decline and fall of the Roman Empire became popular in European circles, but it overstates reality. Too much emphasis on what happened to the empire in Europe. The discussion exception. Non-technical courses will occasionally make use of the class discussion format, in which the professor lets the students lead a discussion on a pre-selected topic or group of topics. The note-taking strategies just described will not fit this environment. When students lead a discussion, you should no longer expect neatly packaged big ideas. Instead, you end up with a lot of random observations surrounding the occasional gem, so in this circumstance, employ the following simplified note-taking strategy. Clearly label the topic of discussion. If a student makes a point that strikes you as insightful, jot it down. If you think up a point that strikes you as insightful, first jot it down, then raise your hand and offer it to the class. Participation keeps you focused. If a student says something you feel is mistaken or irrelevant, just ignore it. And most important, if the professor chimes in, write down what he says and underline it several times. You better believe that his points are insightful. By the end of class, you will be left with a topic followed by a relatively short list of interesting insights. That's all you need. Discussions are supposed to help jog your thinking and perhaps offer interesting ideas for upcoming paper assignments. This approach to note-taking focuses on that goal by identifying only interesting insights and encouraging you to synthesize your own. Take smart notes in technical courses. Where's the problem? Technical courses describe any subject that makes heavy use of mathematical formulas or computer code. For example, math, science, engineering, economics, computer science, and quantitative social science. The note-taking strategies for these courses differ significantly from the strategies we just covered for non-technical courses. In fact, the strategies here are actually much simpler. As Greta, a straight-A student from Dartmouth, explains, for technical courses, you should focus on capturing lots of detailed explanations of problems. The more notes, the better. In other words, you can forget about big ideas. The key to taking notes in a technical course is to record as many sample problems as possible. When you study, these sample problems will prove to be your most important resource. Accordingly, your entire focus in a technical class should be to write down, as faithfully as possible, the steady stream of examples provided by your professor. Let's take a closer look at how to do this. Don't read your assignments, but do keep them handy. Most technical courses have assigned reading. These readings are usually textbook chapters, and they typically focus on a specific technique or formula. Don't do this reading. It may sound blasphemous, but it's the reality of college-level technical courses. Very few students actually do the technical reading ahead of time. Why? Because the exact same material will be covered in class. If you don't understand a topic after it's presented by the professor, then you can go back and use the reading to help fill in the blanks. This ordering of events is much more efficient. What you should do, however, is bring your reading to class. Smart students follow the professor's examples with their textbook open. This significantly improves your understanding of the techniques the first time they are presented, and it helps sharpen your questions when you get lost. Make sure that you